something I did a little bit earlier. New Zealand is the first country in the world to pass a law that requires financial institutions disclose and act on climate-related risks. The bill will involve around 200 of the largest financial market players and requires them to report, and is intended to put climate harm at the centre of their business decision-making, and also, I guess, the decision-making of people investing in them. Earlier, I spoke to the Minister for Climate Change, James Shaw. I began by asking him what kind of companies we're talking about. Insurers? Big banks?
Yes, all things like that, and also some of our largest listed companies on the stock exchange. So they're not all financial institutions, but they're mostly financial institutions.
What are they actually going to have to do? Now, has this legislation been enacted yet, or is it still in bill form at the moment?
It passed its third reading this afternoon.
Right.
So I think that it will be the first bill to have the signature of our new Governor-General.
Oh, really? Dame Cindy. Okay. And what is it going to require companies to?
So it requires them to file a report as part of their annual reporting process on the risks that they are exposed to from climate change. And so there's broadly two categories of risks. One of them is physical risk. So, you know, do I have assets that are located close to the sea line that might be the shoreline that might be exposed to sea level rise? Do I have agricultural businesses that might be exposed to increasingly severe droughts in the future, etc.? The second category of risk is what we call stranded asset risk. And the best example there is, of course, the oil and gas industry, where, you know, you've got significant capital invested in the extraction and the burning of fossil fuels in a world where people are going to stop wanting to use fossil fuels quite rapidly.
I was talking about some of these risks with Sebastian Gayricker from Otago University earlier this week. Why do you think it's important, and what difference will this make in terms of our ability to reduce our fossil fuel emissions by getting companies to state what they are exposed to in terms of climate risk?
Okay, so whilst the reporting requirements only apply to a small number of organisations in the country, virtually all of us are involved with those organisations in some ways. Westpac did one of these reports voluntarily, sort of an early bird kind of shot, if you like, and in that report they showed that something like 2% of their mortgage book is exposed to the risk of sea level rise. So that's people who live on the coastline whose properties are at risk from inundation as the oceans rise due to global warming. And so then what happens is that, you know, the investors and owners and directors and the fund managers and the analysts can look at that and go, oh, okay, that's actually quite a lot of risk. And we'll either price that accordingly or we'll start sending our capital towards lower risk investments that are less exposed to that. And so what you'll see is people starting to shift their money and they'll see higher carbon or more climate risk exposed businesses start to find it more difficult or more expensive to get access to capital. That will start to lead their management to make different decisions about their future investments and the kinds of areas that they want to be involved in. So although it's just a reporting requirement, like it's, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you think that's not a terribly big deal. The flow-through effects could be enormous.
Why the financial sector? Because I'm thinking right now about local government and the exposure that so many councils have to expenditure to do with sea level rise or increased flooding or the risk of drought or even central government.
Yeah. Well, we actually have been doing risk assessments for central government and we're starting to roll them out for local government as well. In this case, this piece of legislation is designed specifically to inform, company management, owners, investors and analysts, so that they can start to move their money to places where it makes more sense. This all comes from an organization called the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, which launched in Paris during the talks that led to the Paris Agreement. And Mark Carney, who at the time was the governor of the Bank of England, and Michael Bloomberg were the chairs of this task force. And Mark Carney said, look, there are trillions of dollars of unquantified, unmeasured, undisclosed and unmanaged risk sitting on corporate balance sheets. And that represents a risk to those companies. It represents a risk to the owners of those companies and the shareholders in those companies. But actually, because of the scale of the risk, it also represents a risk to the financial system itself. And that's why this particular law applies to the financial institutions, because we're all entangled with them in some way. And because that risk is therefore, you know, spread through the entire economy, our Reserve Bank and the Governor Adrian Orr were very keen for us to put this in place, because it helps them to manage climate-related risks to the financial system itself. So it's not just, you know, it's kind of good information for each individual company to have about itself. It's useful information for them, but understanding it, you know, across all companies and across the whole economy is really important.
We're the first country in the world to do this. So here's a question I'm sure you hear a lot, James, and will this make financial companies in New Zealand less competitive compared to overseas? Will it lead to capital flight?
No. What's really interesting is the amount of support that we had for this legislation from the sector itself when we, in the previous term of government, when we went out and consulted and said, you know, we're considering doing something like this. Should it be voluntary? Should it be mandatory? You know, what should it look like? 86% of the businesses came back and said, we should have it and it should be mandatory, because we all know that we're all exposed to this risk. But there's a real problem if I, as a company, suspect this about, you know, my own operations. If I report on this, but my competitor doesn't, then actually I'm exposing myself to even more risk. And my competitor, in the meantime, can continue to cover up. So they wanted it, you know, mandatory, apples with apples comparisons, so that there's a level playing field. And we know that the nature of climate change is such that actually the kind of investment community is getting very, very, very interested in this. So BlackRock, which is one of the largest investment funds in the world, is trying to manage down their climate-related risk all around the world. And I think that what you'll see actually is that capital and investment will become more accessible to New Zealand companies because they're reporting on this. And actually, we know that other jurisdictions, even Australia, whose record on climate's, you know, patchy, but the UK, Canada, a number of jurisdictions are looking at introducing mandatory reporting in one form or another.
You mentioned Australia there, and that reminds me of the leak of documents in Australia, as cited than those in other countries, in terms of background notes ahead of COP26 playing down or trying to, again, slow down the speed of response to global warming. When do you leave for COP26, James?
First week in November, so a couple of weeks.
Okay, how optimistic are you when you know even our nearest buddy might really not be that keen on making real change just yet, still wants to hold off?
Look, I have mixed feelings. So over the course of the last 2 years, there's actually been huge momentum. I think 2 years ago, something like 30% of the global economy was in countries which had committed to a net zero target. Now it's 70%. You know, you've had kind of huge shifts in the individual ambition of countries. So that's good. At the same time, the consensus around the Paris Agreement has really been fraying over the course of the last few years. A lot of that was, you know, due to the US administration at the time. And of course, that's changed. So things are sort of starting to get back on the road. But it's kind of fraught, you know, and John Kerry, who's the, you know, former US Secretary of State, who's now the kind of leading climate envoy, was saying, you know, this is really the last chance saloon if we're going to stay within that 1.5 degrees threshold of global warming. This is the moment right now where we need to knuckle down and get on with it.
They seem to say that at every COP, though, don't they?
Yeah, look, I do hear that. But also, we do know that there is a finite period of time for us to halve global emissions. We've literally got sort of, you know, this decade and by some estimates, not even this decade, to halve the amount of pollution that we're putting into the atmosphere. And that's a huge ask. And so if we kind of say, oh, well, let's leave it till next year, you know, there just aren't that many years left in the decade to be able to do that.
I know, James, you're probably sick of people saying why you're burning fossil fuels to go over there and deal with climate change. But maybe if the global leaders of the world really want to get across to the rest of us how urgent this is, maybe they do need to meet online, not in one country. All of them.
Well, I mean, the suggestion has been made to the hosts of the event. The difficulty that you've got is really one of logistics, right? So there are lots of meetings that you can have online, and there have been a bunch of online meetings in the run-up to COP26 in Glasgow this year. But there are over 30 parallel negotiating rooms, some of which have got dozens and dozens of negotiators from at least as many countries. And those negotiations run up to 16, 20 hours a day. They're kind of around the clock. And you've got people running between them because people are saying, well, I'll make a trade-off in this room if I can get some, you know, some advance in the other room. It's an incredibly complicated event. And it's just not the same thing as, you know, 50 people sitting on a Zoom call going, hey, let's work this out. It just doesn't work that way.
I got a text from Francis. Francis wanted to know, our agricultural emissions are what, 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions?
48.
Roughly? Okay. Now, is that gross emissions or net emissions? In other words, does that take into account the amount of carbon the grass absorbs before it gets eaten by animals?
No, that's, as with everything in the domain of climate change, it's not quite that simple. So that's our net emissions, but... That doesn't include grass, right? It includes forests, because there are some things that we count and some things that we don't, and that's quite a long story.
Yeah, okay, so we can't get a quick answer on that. But no. Agriculture is still not part of the emissions trading scheme, is it? Agricultural emissions are not yet.
No, they're not, and we are the first country in the world to be building an agricultural emissions pricing scheme. You know, and I mean, it's due to come online and for that price to apply from the 1st of January 2025. And it's possible, if the Climate Change Commission thinks that we're not making sufficient progress towards that next year, that they will recommend that we bring agriculture into the emissions trading scheme early. But either way, whether it's 2022 or 2025, nobody else in the world is putting a price on agricultural greenhouse gas emissions. And there are lots of other countries in the world that have farms. And a lot of those countries are looking at us going, well, we really hope you manage to work this out because we're going to need the system that you're building. So, you know,
that's one of the reasons that a lot of farmers get on their tractors and protest, because they're worried about being the first out the blocks in this case.
Yeah,
what can you offer them in return for being part of an ETS scheme?
Well, I mean, a number of things. One of which is that every country in the world that produces food faces exactly the same problem that we do. You know, how do we continue to produce food for a growing population and at the same time reduce our greenhouse gas emissions? And if we, you know, given all of the innovation and the productivity gains that we've had over the last 20 years in that sector, if we can solve that problem, we're not just solving it for ourselves, we're solving it for the rest of the world. So that by itself becomes an export opportunity. The other thing is that, you know, we are trying to move in this country from a volume strategy to a value strategy, which looks at the provenance of the product. You know, what is the conditions that the soil was grown in, the animal welfare conditions, the clean air and, you know, all of that kind of clean green branding that we like to cloak ourselves in. Climate change is an enormous part of that, and we know that some of our largest agricultural companies have had some quite difficult conversations with their customers overseas who have said to them, look, if you don't bring down your emissions, you can no longer sell to us. So, you know, there's a positive upside if we move down this path, which is we'll be able to increase the brand value and the export dollars that are associated with that industry. But if we don't, there's a risk, which comes back to the where we started this conversation, and that risk is that actually our customers won't want what we're selling anymore.
James Shaw, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much for having me. Lovely to talk to you.